Begin by apologizing for last week being away. I realize having packed lectures in one subject and then the other is not ideal. Hopefully we'll be more steady this week and next week. So let me, since we've had a break, let me just briefly summarize what we did Tuesday and Wednesday last week. So we saw that we could rewrite the equations of electromagnetism as four tensor equations, where these indices run over four values, time and space. And we had this vector potential, A mu, and then the field strength of electromagnetism, including the electric and magnetic fields. And we described particles moving in space and time as world lines. And so they follow trajectories with some parameter. And so this is the arena for physics. The arena for physics is the space and time. The four-dimensional space-time, and the objects which live in it are particle coordinates and fields. These fields take values everywhere in the space-time. And then somehow the sort of dramatic assumption is that this whole structure is invariant under various changes of these coordinates, that the coordinates are redundant. Okay, that you can describe physics in one coordinate system just as I could describe what's happening in this room with reference to that corner of the room. I could say I am now, you know, 5 meters along this wall and 10 centimeters away from this wall and so on. So we can always describe physics relative to some coordinate system, but that coordinate system is totally arbitrary. And the arbitrariness is reflected in the, so the coordinates of space-time on space-time are redundant. Okay, redundant means there are more than you need. Somehow we need them. We can't describe physics without coordinates, but we know that whatever coordinates we pick, there's nothing special about them. Okay, so they're redundant, and they're redundant precisely by these by the Poincaré transformations. Okay, so if you chose to describe physics in coordinates which were not based on that corner, but rather this corner, you'd get some completely different expression for your equations, but they should be the same equations. Yep.
So if you use four space-time coordinates, then you have a redundancy. Can't you single out redundancy and use a multiple space-time coordinate?
Logical property.
Pardon?
I mentioned the topological property.
Yes. Let me think about that. I think there is no good way of doing that. There are many advantages of these coordinates. I mean, if I could give the answer more physically, there's no, you know, whenever I define coordinates with reference to something, it should be a physical object. So unless I give you a little bit more information, you're not going to find a more unique set of coordinates. But let me think about it. But in general, no. This is the way that we find we can describe physics with a set of coordinates which is redundant. They're just too many. They're many sets of coordinates describing the same physical process. I mean, if you thought about a simpler example like time, you know, why I always attribute, you know, the lecture starts at 9 a.m., but that's completely conventional definition. You know, if there was a better way of doing it, of describing time, presumably we would have invented that. I mean, I would prefer one which described the lecture relative to the Big Bang. That would make sense. But that would be 14 billion years, you know, plus a little epsilon. And so that wouldn't make a lot of sense. So yes, it's a simple fact about describing the world that we can only describe it in numbers. Yeah, maybe this is a different way of saying it. You see, these coordinates are numbers, after all. And the world is not really numbers. The world are entities. When we get to describe general relativity, it's like a curved space. So we have this picture of a curved space, and the numbers you put on the curved space are not actually representing the curved space. They're simply some coordinates on the curved space. And there are many different coordinates which you could use. And so somehow we have, you know, what's going on in physics is something we cannot directly describe in numbers. We can associate numbers with it, but when we do this, we get redundancies. That's a very, very general feature. So for example, even this quantity, this is not really a physical quantity. The A mu, if I change gauge, you know, plus a derivative, nothing changes in the physics, at least locally. Nothing changes by adding a gradient. And this is another example. We're trying to attribute numbers to this A mu, but it's only numbers up to some operation. Okay, but some quantities are invariant. Are invariant, meaning they're the same in all coordinate systems. And for example, the length of an interval, dx prime nu is, times eta mu nu is equal to dx nu eta mu nu. And we can call that, this is called the line element. Okay, so whichever coordinate system we choose among these coordinate systems related by Poincaré transformations, the line element gives the same value. Okay, are there any questions about that? Okay, so we've done special relativity by thinking about electromagnetism and coupling to particles. Let us now consider more general, or a general coordinate transformation. X prime mu of x. Okay, so up here I considered a linear transformation where the lambda obeyed a special equation, lambda mu eta mu nu lambda mu alpha lambda nu beta is eta alpha beta. Okay, so these are a special class of linear transformations. But now I want to consider a completely general coordinate transformation. If I believe this coordinate redundancy is a fundamental principle, then I would want to consider more general, in fact, completely general coordinate transformation. So if we do such a transformation, then obviously by the chain rule, we get this formula. And we also have the standard formula for partial derivatives. And this Jacobian matrix dx prime mu dx alpha should be non-singular in order, non-singular means that the determinant is not zero, which means it is invertible, in order that the coordinate transformation is one-to-one. Okay, so you want every point in space-time to have some value of x, and you want it also to have some value of x prime, and you want the mapping from x to x prime to be one-to-one, in other words, unique. So each point corresponds uniquely. If it's one-to-one, then it's not hard to show that this Jacobian matrix must be invertible. In other words, the determinant should be non-vanishing. Okay, so now let us impose, if we impose this equation in the following form, eta gamma delta equals, so I just take that equation and divide by the dx or differentiate with respect to the dx's here. In other words, well, I can just use this formula, substitute in the dx prime. This equation should be valid for all dx's. There are four of them. So the coefficients of the dx's must be equal. And you infer this equation, dx prime alpha, dx gamma, dx prime beta, dx delta, must be true. Okay, so this is star. Then eta must be invariant. And this is, of course, just a tensor transformation of eta, where when I did tensor transformations before, I used the lambda. Now, in general, what's going to replace the lambda are simply these Jacobian matrices. OK, so if we take this equation and we differentiate it with respect to x epsilon, then the left-hand side will be 0. Differential of a constant matrix is 0. And the right-hand side, I get alpha beta d2x prime dx dx, dx prime dx. Let me write out all the terms and then put the indices on. Gamma epsilon alpha beta. Okay, so I have this equation. And now comes the sort of trick which Riemann invented. We'd like to prove something about these second derivative matrices, but we've got two terms there. Now, the trick is the following. I've left off an index here. That should be a delta. The trick is the following. To add the term where gamma goes to epsilon. OK, so this term is obviously symmetrical under gamma going to epsilon. But this one is not. We'll change this term. So basically, we get plus the same thing, and then plus, this is alpha beta, eta alpha beta, dx prime dx epsilon, d2x prime beta dx gamma dx delta. And then we subtract the term with delta going to epsilon. Okay, so when I subtract this term, clearly, since that is symmetrical under delta goes to epsilon, I'm going to cancel that term. So let's do that one first. Dx prime gamma, alpha gamma, dx delta, dx epsilon. So these two cancel. Okay, because partial derivatives commute. And over here, I've got eta alpha beta d2x prime alpha dx gamma dx delta dx prime beta dx epsilon. Sorry, minus sign.
Can you repeat? Because I'm a little confused. What have we add and subtract?
So I just took this line,
yes,
flipped these two indices, and added. Okay, so this line represents the first line with gamma replaced by epsilon. Obviously, if the first line is zero,
okay,
and I replace gamma with epsilon, it should still be zero.
Okay.
So now I can just add it.
All right.
Okay. I just added a copy of this line, but with gamma going to epsilon. Then I subtracted a copy of the first line, but with delta going to epsilon. Okay. You might naively think this will get you nowhere. Okay. But in fact, it allows you to cancel one of the two terms. So these two terms cancel here. And then the beautiful thing that happens is this one cancels with that one. Okay? And as I explained, these two are equal. And so this allows you to prove that eta alpha beta d2x prime alpha dx gamma dx epsilon dx beta dx delta equals zero, okay, because this is just twice that quantity. And furthermore, this is invertible, right? Dx prime beta dx delta is invertible, so I can just cancel it. And the zeta is invertible, so I can cancel that too. Okay, so this proves that the second derivative dx gamma dx epsilon equals zero. And then that proves that x prime alpha must be linear in the x's because the second derivative is zero. Okay, Poincaré. So we've just proven that the most general coordinate transformation, which leaves eta invariant, is the Poincaré transformation. There's nothing else. Okay, so that's a nice little trick. This, whenever it'll turn out, whenever we have something with two indices which are symmetric and one other index, we'll use this trick. And we'll use it multiple times. Yep.
So where here did you show that that has to be a Lorentz transformation?
Yes. Well, to show that, so I have proven this equation, right? I've just proven this equation where lambda has to be a constant. And now I'll substitute that back in here, and the A will disappear, and this defines a Lorentz transformation. Okay. So sub back into dagger to show lambda must be Lorentz transformation. Let's call that dagger. Okay, thanks. Okay. And let me just mention in passing, there's a generalization of this calculation which defines conformal transformations. Conformal transformations are not these. These preserve eta. Conformal transformations are one where you're allowed to have an arbitrary function of x multiplying the eta. That I do some coordinate transformation, and I'm left with not eta as the metric, but an arbitrary function of x that's called a conformal factor. It just changes lengths, but not angles. Okay, and if you do that, then you find a bigger group. The Poincaré group is 10-dimensional. There were six of these six parameters in the lambdas, and four here. The conformal group is 15-dimensional in four dimensions, and it's an extremely interesting group and quite fundamental in quantum field theory and probably in the universe too, but we don't quite know how to realize it in the universe.
What are those other 5 degrees of freedom?
The other 5 degrees of freedom, one of them is rather trivial. It's just scale. Okay, so obviously if I say x prime alpha is lambda x alpha with lambda some scale, then when I plug into here, I'm going to get deltas and lambda squared. So I'm just changing eta by a scale. So this is called a dilatation. Okay, and then it turns out there are four others which are called special conformal. Plus four special conformal transformations. And I won't write them down, but they're not linear. They are quadratic in the coordinates. And then there's some sort of interesting features between different dimensions. In two dimensions, it turns out the conformal group is infinite dimensional. But in higher dimensions, it's a finite dimensional group. Okay. So now we see how this all fits together, that this condition has restricted us to the Poincaré symmetry group of physics, and that seems to work. But let us now consider a more general theory. Where the metric eta mu nu is replaced by a metric g mu nu with g mu nu allowed to be any 4x4 symmetric invertible matrix function of x. Okay, so you might say, why symmetric? Well, certainly when we write down the line element, all that matters is the symmetric part. Okay, so when I write down the line element, which is the sort of invariant length since this object is symmetrical under replacing mu and nu, if this has an anti-symmetric piece, it's going to give zero anyway. It won't affect the line element. But in fact, in string theory, it turns out that there is something corresponding to the anti-symmetric part of the metric, and it does appear in the theory. And so somehow just restricting to symmetric is just truncating to remove that piece. Of course, in nature, this thing, like most things in string theory, in nature, it does not appear. Okay, nature prefers simplicity. But anyway, so is it possible to generalize this to include an anti-symmetric two-index tensor? It enters very much like the metric. But for simplicity, it's one doesn't have to. And Einstein's theory doesn't include the anti-symmetric piece. Why invertible? Well, just because we are going to use g mu nu with upstairs indices, just as we used eta with up and down indices. And we're going to use g mu nu, which is the inverse of g with downstairs indices, right, where delta is the Kronecker delta matrix. And so in order to allow us to have that inverse around, we have to demand that G be invertible. Einstein's theory involves both G with downstairs indices and G with upstairs indices. And if you like, the Kronecker delta is the halfway version of G, right? I have G downstairs and I raise one index. Well, that's delta. And if I raise the other index, I get G. You know, using G, I get G with upstairs indices. So delta is sort of the middle version of the tensor G mu nu. And we think of eta. So in physics that we know, without gravity, special relativity doesn't require this G. It only requires eta. Okay, and so what we're going to do is build a theory where everything we know about physics is still going to be valid, because we can think of eta as representing the local value of G. Of g mu nu, theta, think of eta mu nu as representing the local value of g mu nu in some particular state of the theory. Okay, or more colorfully, I can say that in cosmology, this g mu nu is going to be evolving very dramatically, right? And fluctuating. In fact, the whole universe is going to come out of a point, rather bizarrely, but that's what's going to happen. This G is going to actually vanish at the Big Bang singularity. It's not invertible at that moment of time, but G is going to emerge. And then locally in this room, G is going to, it'll be possible to represent G as eta. And then all the laws of special relativity are going to be valid in this room, and I will be able to ignore gravity on locally. So that's the picture. And geometrically, we picture this we say space-time is a curved manifold, and you can think of that as just a curved object. So if I try to represent it, it's something which some kind of curved structure, and the just like a curved sheet, if you try to picture it as a two-dimensional surface, you'd say it's a curved sheet. And these are the coordinates. And then obviously there's an infinite number of way of putting putting coordinates on any curved surface, and that redundancy is precisely what replaces the redundancy we had in special relativity. It's a much more general redundancy, and the description, the physics, will be invariant under general coordinate transformations. Okay, so Einstein's goal was to discover the equations which would determine this metric, in the hope that those equations are going to allow Minkowski space, Minkowski space-time, in other words, G equals eta, as a special solution. And then, of course, the bigger plan is to discover the boundary conditions for those equations, which would actually determine the G menu for the universe. And that's what we're trying to do these days. Okay, so I hope you can see that what he was trying to do is extremely natural generalization of special relativity. And of course, he had a clue. He had a clue from nature, which is that this other force, which is gravity, and furthermore, which nobody knew how to describe in special relativity. And furthermore, gravity has a very special property, which is that all objects fall at the same rate, okay, which Galileo had understood. Objects fall at a rate independent of their mass. And that suggested to Einstein that the explanation for the force and the rate of falling is something universal, that basically objects fall at the same rate because they're all living in the same space. And what determines their falling is the curvature of that space. Okay, so it was a very profound insight which led Einstein to explore this and to ask what kind of equations could possibly determine G mu nu in general. Now, before we get to those, hopefully we'll get to those equations this week, but before we get to those equations, let's just notice a property of the G mu nu. You can always choose coordinates in the neighborhood of any point in space-time, such that the metric is such that G mu nu at that point, let me write it this way, G mu nu equals eta mu nu, and G and the first derivative of G, d by d x alpha G mu nu, which I'll define to be G mu nu comma alpha. Okay, so a single comma denotes differentiation, and it's a lowered index because I'm dividing by dx alpha, equals 0 at that point. Okay, so we're going to prove this, that if I give you some arbitrary 4x4 symmetric invertible matrix, which is a function of x, and then you tell me a particular point, which in that coordinate system would be some particular value of x, I can always change coordinates around that point so that this becomes true, so that the metric at that point in the new coordinates is just eta, and the first derivative of the metric is zero. So locally, up to second derivatives, the metric looks like Minkowski. Now, do you think those coordinates would be unique, the locally flat coordinates? If I, you see, sort of look at this picture and just pick any point, for example, this one, and work in some small vicinity of that point, it's intuitively clear there should be some sort of tangent space, and the tangent space provides a very good approximation to the real space around that point. Okay, do you think these coordinates are unique? Yes?
Can I just rotate in the tangent plane?
What is a rotation? You're right, but what is a rotation?
So a rotation in
space-time.
This is
space-time. This really includes the time coordinate. Exactly. So Lorentz transformation is the rotation you're talking about. So you're free to. So if I manage to pick these coordinates, they're not unique, because I could still do a Lorentz transformation while preserving this fact that g is eta. A conformal would not, because it will change the scale of eta. Okay, but and so we're going to prove that the coordinates are not unique. Locally flat coordinates aren't unique, but they're unique up to Lorentz transformations. Actually, up to Poincaré transformations. Okay, so let us prove that. So the proof is completely elementary. And all we do is we write down the coordinate transformation formula. So the only subtlety about it is whether you consider it. So naively, you'd say, I have some coordinates x, and I want to go to x prime, and so I should think of x prime as a function of x. But it's actually more convenient algebraically to think of x as a function of x prime. Okay? Since the mappings are one-to-one, they have to be one-to-one in order for it to be a good transformation, you can think of x prime as a function of x, or x prime as a function, or x as a function of x prime. That should be equivalent. That is possible, provided the Jacobian matrix is non-singular, in other words, invertible. And so it's just more convenient algebraically to think of x as a function of x prime, as we will see. Okay. I'll just make a little note to that effect. It's convenient to think of x prime rather than x prime of x. Now, why is that? Because in the end, I'm going to insist that this g prime guy is equal to eta at a particular point, and I'm going to insist that the first derivative of it in the new coordinates be zero, right? So I want to play around with this object, and so it's easier to write it this way. And what I'll be doing is determining conditions on these Jacobian matrices and showing that I can find a function x of x prime, which is invertible, and which will ensure that this g prime is eta and the first derivative of g prime is zero in the x prime coordinates. Now, we have, let's imagine the point concerned is at x alpha equals x prime alpha equals 0. Okay, so I'm just going to do the special case where the point I'm talking about is at the origin of both coordinate systems. It's very easy to generalize this. We're going to use Taylor series. And in Taylor series, you can, if you expand around some other point, you know, A, x equals A, well, when I do a Taylor series, it's just in x minus A instead of in x. So that sort of just simplifies the algebra. But completely straightforward to generalize. Okay, so the point we're talking about is at x and x prime equals 0. Now, we must have that the original metric we're going to assume the original metric is a smooth function of the coordinates. I mean, otherwise, we would probably say these are not very good coordinates. And so the metric will be whatever it is at the point 0 plus, so this is just a Taylor series, assume g alpha beta of x has a Taylor series in four dimensions. So just the usual Taylor series, but with four independent coordinates, x lambda plus 1/2 g alpha beta comma lambda sigma of 0, x lambda x sigma plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so you can prove this formula, or prove it's consistent anyway. Obviously, if I set x equals 0, I get g of 0 on the right-hand side and g of 0 on the left-hand side. Also, if I differentiate this with respect to x, x lambda, say, and then set x equals 0, this disappears, and I have g alpha beta comma lambda at 0 equal to this coefficient. And if I differentiate it twice and then set x equals 0, all the higher order terms will disappear. These terms all disappear, and I get that coefficient on the left and right hand sides. And that the coordinate transformation also has a Taylor series. Okay, so x alpha, as I said, it's more convenient to think about x as a function of x prime because that's what comes into this formula. So x alpha will be k alpha beta x prime beta with k some constant matrix plus, in fact, I used index gamma here. Plus 1/2, and then I've got a 3-index coefficient. And then I have 1/6 and a 4-index coefficient. Plus dot, dot, dot. These are primed. So this is x alpha of x prime. Okay, and there's no constant term precisely because because x prime equals 0 corresponds to x equals 0, which is the point around which I am Taylor expanding. Okay, now it's rather easy because all I do, let's call that star, is we substitute these two Taylor series into star sub these into star and set G prime mu nu of 0 equals eta mu nu. Okay, so what I get is that so star becomes eta mu nu on the left hand side. And on the right-hand side, I've got g alpha beta at 0. So this term at 0, evaluated at 0, can ignore everything else because I'm taking x equals 0, multiplied by the first derivative of the coordinate transformation, which is just this term. So I get k alpha mu k beta nu. And that's all. And if we write these as matrices, we've got eta equals k k transpose g k. Okay, regarding this as the column, this is, and the upper index is the row. So this is the row and the column. And then for this one, I have to transpose it in order that I get the right summations. And now what we have to do is just find the matrix K, which yields eta when I use it to conjugate, when I conjugate the metric with it. And so we just solve this via k equals O times L, where O is an orthogonal matrix. O is orthogonal, and O transpose G O is equal to lambda, which is diagonal. Okay, so since G is a symmetric matrix, G at a point is a symmetric 4x4 matrix, there exists an orthogonal matrix which will diagonalize it. What we're going to assume is that when you do diagonalize it, you get three positive eigenvalues and one negative. We have to assume G has one negative and three positive eigenvalues. Okay. And as long as that is true, that G has one negative and three positive eigenvalues, I can always find the matrix O such that OTGO is something like this, with L0, L1, L2, and L3 real. Okay, and then the second step is to notice that I still have the freedom to pick L, and all I do is pick L to be 1 over L0, 1 over L1, 1 over L2, 1 over L3, with zeros everywhere else. And then I get K transpose G K equals eta. Okay, so there's precisely enough degrees of freedom in K, or enough parameters in K, to ensure that I can choose, that I can find a K such that this equation is true. Now, obviously, if I changed K, if K goes to if K goes to OL lambda with lambda a Lorentz transformation, we still get G prime equals eta. So there's a redundancy in K that K is not fully determined by this procedure. I'm still allowed to use a Lorentz transformation, and that won't change the answer. So if we count parameters, the orthogonal 4 by 4 matrices, how many parameters do they have? 6. This diagonal matrix has 4. And the Lorentz transformations have how many? 6, right? So this is 16. So K is a 4 by 4 matrices. 6 of its parameters are Lorentz transformations. The other 10 are used to get the metric into this, into the form of eta. Yes, you had a question.
You have two things called lambda there, but they're not the same thing. The diagonal matrix and the Lorentz transformation.
Oh, yeah, sorry, bad notation. Let's call it D. Okay, sorry about that. Yes.
But the choice for L doesn't, it's not fixed by the result of applying transpose of O to G and then, well, and then again O. It's like we were forced to take that L, even O, right? But,
sorry?
Like, we are counting 4 numbers for L. Like, you can have 3, but it's like fixed after the result of O T and
Yes. Well, do it in two steps. First of all, I pick O to as an orthogonal matrix which diagonalizes G.
Yeah.
Okay, that's unique.
Yeah.
Up to probably up to -1 or something, but it's the parameter counting is at least correct. So there is an orthogonal matrix which will make G diagonal. Once it's diagonal, then there's an obvious choice for L, which is this guy, because what I have here is I want this is made of D, so this becomes L D L. L transpose is the same as L, and I just want this to be equal to eta, and there is an obvious choice, which is this one. It's not unique, as you say, because I could equally well pick L times lambda.
All right.
And let's see, which way do I want to do it? Transpose. Yes, I want K to be, I want these things in the right order. Yeah, this is really transpose, so this would be lambda transpose.
Okay.
Okay, and so I pick L to make this into eta, and then I see I can still do a lambda without changing the answer. Okay, so the change of coordinates is not unique, but there always exists a change of coordinates so that the metric is eta. So let's now go to the. So we've satisfied the first condition up there. We've found coordinates so that g equals eta. What we need is to satisfy the second, that the first derivatives are zero in the new coordinates, in the x prime coordinates. And so we just continue the calculation. Yes?
So here we only have a Lorentz transformation. We don't have a translation.
I forgot about those because I put both points at zero.
So we will have like.
If I didn't make this assumption, then the only thing that would change would be this, would be that it's at some constant here, and these become x minus a lambda, x minus a sigma, and so on. Nothing would change. I've just ignored that in order to simplify the algebra.
So I will get an object from here that we will have like four parameters now.
No, because it will all disappear. You see, if the point is at x equals a, then all of these terms disappear when I calculate the equation in exactly the same way. So the a would change nothing. It should be there. It is the Poincaré group, but its action is sort of trivial and doesn't really affect the algebra. So you're welcome to put it in, but just to simplify the formulae, I left it out. So the translation part of things are really quite trivial because they don't affect derivatives at all. Okay, so let's go to, we want to show that we can choose this. We can choose this. Let me call this dagger, the coordinate transformation, such that d by dx prime alpha g mu nu of g prime mu nu equals 0 at x equals x prime equals 0. Okay, we want to show that we can choose this coordinate. We've got a lot of freedom. You see, we've sort of fixed this matrix K up to Lorentz transformations. K is given by this formula. We fixed it up to Lorentz transformation. We still have all this freedom. These L can be any constants we like. So a huge number of constants we can choose, and even more. And now what we'll do next is to show that we can choose L to ensure that the first derivative of the metric is 0 at this point we're talking about. So just calculate g prime mu nu comma lambda at 0. How do I do that? I just take this formula star, differentiate it with respect to x prime, okay, and use this formula to determine the relationship between d by d x prime and d by dx, because this is the transformation from x to x prime. So that's a little bit of algebra. Let me just write down the answer. This is the first derivative at 0. And then we just get the metric. Sorry. Okay, so let me try and justify that. You see, I'm taking d by dx prime of the right-hand side there. So first of all, I've got to differentiate the g. So what I want to do is compute d by dx prime of g of x. Well, this is a function of x, so I need to change this to d by dx. Right? And so the dx dx prime gives me dx dx prime gives me k. Okay, so obviously the first term involves a k times the derivative of the metric, and that's exactly this term. And then the two dx dx primes are just give me these two terms. Right, so I just differentiate and then take x equals x prime equals 0. The second term comes because I need to differentiate the Jacobian matrix with respect to x prime, right? So I get this. So I get g of 0, and then I get d2x dx prime dx prime, and then dx dx prime. Now, the second derivative of x with respect to x prime eliminates this term and leaves that term. Gets rid of the factor of 2 as well, because there are two factors of x prime here. And so that just gives me an L. And this guy gives me a K. And so that's how we get this term. There are two pieces. One is coming from the first d2x dx 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 prime dx prime, and the other one from differentiating the second Jacobian matrix. Okay, so what we want to set this equal to 0. So can we choose L alpha mu lambda so that the right-hand side equals 0? Okay, that's the question. Well, it's fairly obvious we can, because g is invertible and k is invertible, right? K is the Jacobian matrix at the point. It has to be invertible by assumption. So yes, since g and k, g of 0 and k beta nu, are invertible. Okay, so I can just solve this equation for the constants L. And by the way, it's obvious that there's the right number of parameters in L to cancel all of these, right? The G alpha beta comma delta consists of how many parameters? Well, this is a symmetric. It's symmetric under these two indices. So they're d plus 1 over 2 in d dimensions, because this is a symmetric matrix, and then multiplied by d, because there are d independent derivative indices, parameters. Okay, so just think of this as a big constant matrix, and it has to include this many parameters. But of course, the L has just the same number of parameters. L mu lambda also is symmetrical under mu and lambda. When I wrote this down, you see, if this gamma and delta are down here, if this were anti-symmetric, it wouldn't contribute to this at all. So when I write this down, then implicitly I'm assuming the L is symmetric under those two indices. And so this also has d plus 1 over 2 times d. This is d alpha indices. OK, so they're the right number of parameters to cancel the first derivatives. The right number of parameters in the coordinate transformation at second order in x prime to cancel the derivatives of the metric at one point.
Don't we have like extra parameters in K?
We've used all those up in order to ensure G1 to eta, apart from the Lorentz transformations. Okay, so we had a little bit of redundancy here. There's, let's see, is there any redundancy there? That's a good question. I don't think there is any, because these are invertible, so L is unique. Yeah. So there's no redundancy in the L constants. Okay, so so this is exactly the calculation, the kind of calculation Riemann did in 1820 or something like that, as part of his PhD. And we're expecting similar things from all of you. Okay. But to be honest, it was a little boring up to this point, because there wasn't anything really very exciting. We're about to see something exciting, which is the Riemann tensor. Okay, so Riemann was trying to say how do I characterize a curved space as opposed to a flat space? And what we've seen is that you can pick the metric to be the flat metric, eta mu nu, the metric of flat space-time. Of course, Riemann didn't have time and space. He only had space. So Riemannian manifold is one where you have all pluses here. Okay, plus, 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 plus. But the only addition of relativity was to sort of put a minus sign there. But apart from that, Riemann realized you can choose coordinates locally at any point. So the metric is flat, in his case, the Kronecker delta metric, and the first derivative vanishes. But when you go to the second derivatives, it becomes much more interesting. So what we want to do is try to set d2 g mu nu prime of x prime dx prime alpha dx prime beta equals 0. So I want to try and set the second derivative of the metric to 0. I mean, I'm trying to make it flat. Can I choose a coordinate transformation such that this equals 0. And you find you cannot. In general. And the obstruction to doing so is precisely the Riemann tensor. So the math is, the algebra is quite involved, so I'm only going to do it heuristically. You can see it's totally straightforward, but messy. So when we calculate this quantity, again, I'm going to get two derivatives on the G in the front of the right-hand side. Those two derivatives on G are going to give me this quantity, right? So on the left-hand side, we're going to get d x prime g prime of x prime, all evaluated at x prime equals 0. And that's what I want to set. I want to try to set 0. On the right-hand side, we're going to get known terms. You see, on the right-hand side over there, we got known terms in the first piece. We had meaning terms depending on k. All right, and when I differentiate this g, I'm going to get terms I already know. I assume I know these things. So I'm going to get terms I already know. And then the dx dx prime, because I'm taking two derivatives, I will be up to third derivatives of dx dx prime. So I'm going to get this thing, which is still unknown. So what I'm going to get is known plus terms in M times known. And the question is, can I solve this equation? Can we solve this for M? Okay, so what is M? Well, M is quite a big object. There are lots of parameters. So M, alpha, and then gamma, delta, lambda. How many? So I've got some parameters in here. How many have I got? Well, it's quite easy, because this is a symmetric tensor on these three indices. So I have d plus 1, d plus 2 over 6. Right? Remember when I had a symmetric two-index matrix, I said the number of components is d, d plus 1 over 2. When you have a symmetric three-index object, then just by looking at the permutations of those indices, you can see, so these indices give you this number, and this index can take d values. So this has this many independent components. Okay, so this is symmetric under permutations of gamma, delta, lambda. Okay, so this matrix has a certain number of parameters in it, this matrix M. And we're trying to use it to set to 0 all of these quantities. But, so let's write this out, d alpha, d beta, g mu nu, these are all primed. And how many independent second derivatives of the metric are there? Well, let's write it this way, g prime mu nu comma alpha beta. So this is symmetric under mu and nu, right? It's also symmetric under alpha and beta. And so think of this as a big matrix whose first index is these two, and whose second index is these two. And so the indices here take the value, take d plus 1 over 2 values. And this takes d plus 1 over 2 values, right? And so this has just the square, d plus 1 over 2 squared independent components. Okay, and then Riemann's exciting observation is that these numbers are not equal. All right, that you do not have enough freedom in the coordinates to set all the second derivatives of the metric to be zero. And so so there are fewer available parameters than there are quantities, than there are G mu nu, comma alpha beta. So we cannot set them all zero. Okay, so the number, residual number, which cannot be set zero, cannot in general be set zero, is just d plus 1 over 2 squared minus d squared d plus 1 d plus 2 over 6. And that's equal to d squared minus 1 over 12. And this, which will turn out to be exactly the number of components, of independent components of a tensor called the Riemann tensor. So in particular, if we're in one dimension, then we can set everything zero. Okay, and in one dimension, there is no meaningful notion of curvature of a space. In two dimensions, this is 1. This is 4 times 3 over 12, so it's 1. And in two dimensions, there's only one component of curvature. When I think about a sphere can be curved, and that single component, a sphere in 2D, is curved, and its curvature is measured by the Riemann tensor, and so on. So in fact, for any curved manifold, we can choose coordinates in the neighborhood of any point such that G gmenu of x equals eta mu nu at the point. And then when we go to second order, it looks like this. And these are Riemann normal coordinates. Okay, where this is the Riemann tensor evaluated at the point zero. Okay, so we'll see that later on. And this Riemann tensor is going to have some very nice expression in terms of the metric and its second derivatives. Okay, what we did there is we solved for the m in terms of these second derivatives. It'll turn out that the Riemann tensor depends only on the second derivatives of the metric.
How did you
factorize
the 1/3?
We'll see that later. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you'll see it later. Yeah, when we haven't yet defined the Riemann tensor. We will define it in a completely general way, and then once we've done that, it'll be possible to see that there's a third here. Doesn't really matter for this discussion. Okay, so I'll leave it there. Are there any questions? Yes.
For two dimensions, when you occur, you mean like Gaussian curve?
Two dimensions, the... I haven't talked about Gaussian curvature at all. Everything I'm doing is intrinsic. I'm not talking about how the surface is embedded into higher dimensions. I will discuss that a little bit later. For Einstein's theory of gravity, you don't need to think about embeddings at all. And so the only place in which Gaussian curvature comes in as a useful concept is when we embed one space in another. So often, for example, in cosmology, it's useful to think of space as embedded in space-time. And so this moment of time, if I think about the geometry of the universe and propagate it forward, there is some... the embedding creates some curvature, and that we call the Hubble constant. And the Hubble constant is nothing but the Gaussian curvature of space in the expanding universe. But if from the 4D perspective, the whole idea is to do everything intrinsically and not to even think about any embedding. Okay, so we're just not going to use the notion of Gaussian curvature at all. Gaussian curvature always arises only when you think about embedding. Any other questions?
Everyone happy? Is there a class this afternoon?
Yes.
What time?
At 2.
2. Okay, 2. So again, I will try my best to drop by. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.